help of God. I also assure all our countrymen of their safety. Don't be scared and resume your normal life.
As facts on the ground show, the Taliban are trying to gain popularity among all as a move to help them strengthen their rule over the country. They say their agenda is to provide security for all Afghans, including women and minorities who have suffered decades of invasion, war, injustice and insecurity. The fall of capital Kabul has created a big question in the minds of rural Afghans. That is, how can the Taliban bring unity, improvement and lasting peace to gain public support in the country?
We are tired of war and ask the Taliban to prove how they are planning to gain people's trust and support the rule over the country.
The fall of Kabul has prompted many Afghans to leave their country for fear of their life. Reports say at least 5 people were killed in the airport as Afghans scrambled to flee. According to eyewitnesses, American troops repeatedly shot in the air to dispel the crowds. Video released on social media showed dozens of people running alongside a U.S. plane as it taxied along the runway before takeoff. Afghanistan's Civil Aviation Authority says that the airspace had been released to the military and advised transit flights to reroute, saying there would be no air traffic control. Most countries have begun to evacuate their citizens along with diplomatic staff, with the U.S. planning to deploy more troops in Afghanistan to hasten its evacuation. Hundreds of Afghans, including those in possession of visas, have rushed into Kabul International Airport to get a flight and flee the country. This proves that the hope and optimism of Afghans on the fate of their country have smashed due to what most here believe is the outcome of heavy U.S. military presence in the country over the past 2 decades. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
On Sunday, August 15, 2021, India celebrated its 75th Independence Day. In Indian-administered Kashmir, the main event to mark the day was held in the region's capital city, Srinagar. The region's Lieutenant Governor Manoj Sinha unfurled the national flag and took salute from the parade. The event was largely attended by government functionaries. The region's officials had temporarily relaxed COVID restrictions for Independence Day.
Revocation of Article 370 marked the beginning of a new era for Jammu and Kashmir. A neighboring country which does not care for its own people has been making malicious attempts to instigate our youth. They will be given a befitting reply.
While the mood inside the stadium was ecstatic, outside the people observed spontaneous shutdown to protest what they call New Delhi's failure to address the wishes and aspirations of the people. They say that New Delhi's stripping of Kashmir's special status in 2019 has further alienated the people of Kashmir.
Independence Day is important for every nation, and those who are celebrating independence on 15th August or 14th August across the border, they must realize that Kashmiris too have aspiration, and this aspiration must be respected.
The authorities had heightened security, deployed sharpshooters and pressed drones into service to keep watch over the region's capital city and prevent any attack by the armed pro-independence groups. They also issued directions to heads of educational institutes to hoist the Indian flag at their respective schools. The order has drawn strong criticism from different quarters. Meanwhile, unlike the past, internet and mobile services have remained unaffected on the Independence Day in Kashmir. Kashmir is a bone of contention between India and Pakistan. Both the nations claim the region in full, but rule it in parts.
As India celebrates its 75th Independence Day, life here in Kashmir has again come to a grinding halt. Observers believe unless New Delhi addresses the basic issue of Kashmir and reduces the trust deficit, it cannot win the hearts and minds of the people here. Sayed Ali Safir, Indian-administered Kashmir.
Palestinians took part in a rally in the Gaza Strip marking the 20th anniversary of the killing of Abu Ali Mustafa, the leader of the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. Abu Ali Mustafa was assassinated in an Israeli attack in Ramallah in 2001. Palestinians said they participated in this rally to renew their support for the Palestinian resistance, expressing they will continue the road of resistance in defending their rights.
Today, the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine is marking the 20th anniversary of the assassination of our leader, Abu Ali Mustafa. By holding this huge rally titled With Knowledge and Resistance, we will build the next generation of freedom and victory. We view the resistance as the only way out of the current crisis. We have many allies from Iran to Syria, Lebanon and Al-Quds, which stand against the Israeli regime.
This rally comes in conjunction with the Resistance Front warning it won't tolerate any more Israel's reluctance to meet Palestinians' demands, especially those related to ending the suffocating siege imposed on the Gaza Strip.
Today, all Palestinian resistance factions are marking Abu Ali Mustafa's assassination, vowing to follow in the footsteps of their leaders. Today, Palestinians are involved in a continuous struggle against Israel, especially in Al-Quds, defending their lands. We call for a unified stance in fight against the occupation.
Organizers said this event marks the ongoing resistance until the main goals of all Palestinians are achieved. Resistance factions renewed their pledge to defend the Palestinian people and sent a new warning to the Israeli regime that the coming generations are the generations of liberation.
We believe that generations after generations will keep resisting against Israeli occupation. The Israeli regime should be held accountable for its crimes, and the international community should break its silence towards them.
Palestinians here stress on not only support their resistance and follow the steps of the leaders, but also defend their rights with all means until liberating all Palestine. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
What started as a quiet day for the residents of Keyham in Plymouth, southwest England, ended with a tragedy. A mass shooting by a white male who took six lives, including his own. The mood here, one of absolute shock and horror.
Sad as well, obviously, all the people that have lost their lives, the people that are injured, the people that are affected by it. It's just sickening.
It's completely wrong to kill innocent people and your own family. It's not fair. It's not acceptable. The guy needed help, evidently. He probably wasn't given the help he needed.
I mean, it is very scary. Like, you just don't want to go out, do you? You want to stay inside and be safe.
Jake Davidson, a 23-year-old apprentice crane operator, was a licensed gun owner who launched a lone wolf attack using a pump-action shotgun, according to witnesses.
It all started with the gunman shooting a woman in one of the houses up that hill behind me and ended with him taking his own life. Six lives lost in nearly 6 minutes.
Police said his motive was still unknown.
There is no motive as we know at present. Again, that will be subject to inquiry, but we are at the moment not considering terrorism or a relationship with any far-right group or any such other group.
But Davidson's social media accounts offer a window into his state of mind. A case in point, a video post on YouTube where he considers himself as the Terminator.
The whole premise of the Terminator movies is that, you know, everything's rigged against you. There's no hope for humanity. You know, we're on the brink of extinction.
He was also believed to have been a member of Incel, a notorious online community of celibate men with misogynistic views. Police have called the incident not terror-related, raising questions about whether the police would give the same designation if the gunman were someone from a minority group. The UK has stringent gun ownership laws. The last time such an incident happened was in 2010, perpetrated by a taxi driver who killed 18 people and injured several more. It's almost clear Davidson was radicalized online, which begs the question whether the authorities could have done more to prevent the horrifying killing spree. Saeed Puriza, Plymouth.
Another another illegal move on Yemen soil has taken place by the United Kingdom, as it has sent 40 soldiers of its special forces and an electronic warfare unit to Al-Marib province in eastern Yemen, on the pretext of finding the perpetrators of an attack on an Israeli-managed oil tanker off the coast of Oman last month.
Such UK moves in Yemen are not new, whether in Al-Mahra or elsewhere. Britain has an agent in the region, the UAE. All of Britain's efforts in Yemen, through its Emirati proxy, are focused on advancing the interests of the Israeli regime. What's happening today is considered a betrayal to the country by former President Abdrabbu Mansour Hadi. He has kept mum in the face of the British-Israeli moves in violation of Yemen's sovereignty.
An observer believes Saudi Arabia is the party behind the recent attack on the ship and says the deployment of the UK forces is aimed at justifying the presence of Saudi Arabia in Al-Mahra, as the regime has failed to take control of the province that has the longest coastal strip on the Arabian Sea.
The deployment of British soldiers to Al-Mahra came in the wake of the attack carried out by Saudi Arabia against the Mercer Street oil tanker. Ansar Allah was accused of being behind the attack, but this accusation was later denied. The presence of the British forces was planned beforehand. Since Saudi Arabia has failed to control the province of Al-Mahra, and many people there are against the presence of Saudi forces, and they cannot remain there for a long time, as there are capable military forces in the country.
The people of Al-Mahra have repeatedly voiced protest against the presence of Saudis on their land. However, the presence of foreign forces in Yemen is not limited to the UAE, Saudi Arabia, or the UK. A US plane carrying 300 American soldiers and officers, along with 12 Black Hawk helicopters, arrived in Aden in southern Yemen last month.
Yemenis say the recent UK move proves that colonial ambitions by foreign powers are rising rapidly amid fragile situation in the southern and eastern areas of Yemen. They have also made it clear that they will continue fighting until all of Yemen's land is liberated and foreign forces are pushed out of the country. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Sudan has officially agreed to hand over ousted President Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court, along with other officials wanted over the Darfur conflict. The International Criminal Court chief prosecutor held talks with Sudanese officials in accelerating practical steps to hand over those wanted by the court over alleged atrocities committed in Darfur.
I'm pleased to announce that the reason I was late was I was signing a memorandum of understanding with the government of Sudan that was signed by me as the prosecutor and by the Minister of Justice.
Al-Bashir is currently in Khobar prison in the Sudanese capital. He was dismissed and arrested in April 2019 following a massive popular protest movement against him. ICC Chief Prosecution Karim Khan said he will accomplish his mission in order to meet the expectations of the international community, especially with regard to Security Council resolutions to achieve justice about the victims of Darfur. Last week, the Sudanese cabinet approved Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court in what was considered as a new step towards trying al-Bashir before this international judicial body in The Hague. In 2009, the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for al-Bashir, accusing him of committing war crimes and crimes against humanity during the armed conflicts in Darfur that erupted in 2003 and kill more than 300,000 people.
The Sudanese government decision to ratify the Rome Statute will make the government closer to international justice. But as observers say, it also divides the political parties in the country for and against. Muhammad Ali Fazari, Khartoum.
Ibrahim Raisi handed to Parliament a list of his proposed cabinet ministers a week after he took the oath of office as Iran's new president. Legislators now have 1 week to review the credentials of Raisi's picks before an open vote of confidence session is held with the presence of the president himself to defend his nominees.
For 1 week, 13 Parliament commissions will be working three shifts a day, where they will be host the proposed ministers, asking them about their plans and visions. 3 days after the one-week time frame is over, open sessions will be held in Parliament where the proposed ministers will take the podium one by one to lay out their plans and take questions from lawmakers.
The list consists of 19 nominees for 19 ministerial posts. Among the proposed names are Hossein Amir Abdullahian as the new foreign minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani as the defense minister, and Ismail Khatib as the intelligence minister. Lawmakers seem to not have issues with the proposed list and have promised to be cooperative with the new administration.
There will definitely be synergy and convergence between parliament and the government. We need to work together to solve the country's economic problems. We are determined to remove the illegal sanction imposed on the nation, so lawmakers and the new administration must join hands to achieve this goal.
Ebrahim Raisi won the June 18th election by landslide, securing 64% of the vote. He was sworn in on August 4th, 2 days after he was officially endorsed by Iran's leader. Raisi had 2 weeks to introduce his proposed cabinet lineup, but he released the list a week ahead of the deadline. Parliament says it will be swift to review the nominated ministers in order to speed up the formation of the new cabinet.
If all goes as planned, open floor vote of confidence sessions will be held after the week-long deliberations over the credentials of the proposed ministers will conclude behind closed doors. Given the close ties between the Iranian parliament and the new government, lawmakers expect that the vote of confidence process will wrap up in a matter of 3 work shifts. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
In an attempt to blunt international opposition to Israeli settlement construction in the occupied territories, Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett is pushing through plans for more than 2,000 settler units in the occupied West Bank, and at the same time has decided, after long years, to grant a rare authorization for 836 Palestinian homes in Area C of the occupied West Bank. It's virtually impossible for Palestinians to get construction permits from Israeli authorities. Palestinians say Bennett is trying to deceive the world by the so-called equalization.
All this announcement is just to tell a fake message to the world that we are equalizing. So we give the Palestinian permissions. It's not true that we are destroying. This is like a wrong message that will be given to the international community. We should confront it as a Palestinian, and also international community should also confront that. This is a Palestinian occupied land, and Israel don't have the right either to build the settlements or to give the Palestinians in their homeland and permission to build their houses.
Under the interim Oslo Agreement signed between the Palestine Liberation Organization and the Israeli regime in 1993, the West Bank was divided into 3 areas. Area A under Palestinian control, Area B under Palestinian and Israeli control, and Area C under full Israeli control, and this comprises some 60% of the occupied West Bank. Israel prevents Palestinians from constructing private or public buildings in Area C under different pretexts, such as using the land as military training zone or it locates close to settlements and other claims.
Israel is controlling Palestinians' lives in these areas. It prevents them from constructing new homes in their own lands. The new move is aimed at covering up Israel's future plans for new settlement projects in the Palestinian lands.
At the end of the day, it's almost impossible for Palestinians in Area C to get Israeli-issued building permits. Moreover, Israeli forces on a daily basis destroy and demolish Palestinian structures in the same area for lack of construction authorization, despite the policy deemed illegal by the international community.
Palestinians don't take Israel's new move seriously, saying what matters for Tel Aviv is to execute its plan known as the Classified C Areas, which is aimed at putting an end to the presence of Palestinians on the mentioned areas. Mona Qandil, Occupied Ramallah.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. Thank you.
supplication on Thursdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who has taken away the shadowy night by His power and brought the sight-giving day through His mercy. He has clothed me in its brightness and given me its favor. O Allah, just as Thou hast spared me for this day, so also spare me for its likes. Bless the Prophet Muhammad and his household, and torment me not in it and in other nights and days by allowing me to commit unlawful acts and to clothe myself in sins. Provide me with its good, the good of all within it, and the good of everything after it, and turn away from me its evil, the evil of all within it, and the evil of everything after it. O Allah, by the protective compact of Islam, I seek mediation with Thee, and by the inviolability of the Quran, I rely upon Thee. By Muhammad, the Chosen, Allah bless him and his household, I seek intercession with Thee. So recognize my protective compact, by which I hope my need will be granted. O most merciful of the merciful, O Allah, decree for me on Thursday five things, which none embraces but Thy generosity, and none supports but Thy favors. Health through which I may have the strength to obey Thee. Worship by which I may deserve Thy plentiful reward. Plenty in my state through lawful provision. And that Thou makest me secure in the places of fear through Thy security. And placest me in Thy fortress against the striking of worries and sorrows. Bless Muhammad and his household. And make my seeking his mediation as an intercessor give profit on the day of resurrection. Surely, Thou art the most merciful of the merciful.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. The Taliban has now taken control of Afghanistan. What the U.S. couldn't do in 20 years, the Taliban did in a matter of days. Why did Afghanistan fall to the Taliban at warp speed? And furthermore, why didn't the Afghan army put up a resistance and fight, especially in Kabul? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will ask all of those questions from our guests and look at what it means for the country, its neighbors, and the world. First, let's get the latest. We cross on over to Afghanistan's capital, Kabul, to talk to Amin Alami. Okay, Amin, at this point, lots of developments have occurred in the country. Tell us the highlights of what has occurred, especially some of the, I guess, statements that came from the emergency session of the UN Security Council.
Of course, following the Taliban capture of the Afghan capital, Kabul, and declared that the war in Afghanistan is over, many regional and international bodies, including the United Nations, expressed their concern about the possible violation of human rights, women's rights, and many other similar issues in Afghanistan under the rule of Taliban over this country. Since the Taliban appeared inside the city of Kabul, people of Afghanistan were scared during the first moments and even during the first day of their presence here in Afghanistan's capital, Kabul. Later on the day and even all over the night, hundreds of Afghans rushed into Kabul International Airport. As a result of an stampede, at least five individuals lost their lives, and as there were too much crowded, American forces also shoot it on air and called the people who had rushed into the Kabul International Airport to be away from the military aircrafts that were inside the Kabul International Military Airport. In the meantime, the UN Security Council and the recent emergency meeting on the Afghanistan also shows that there is an international concern regarding to the fate of Afghanistan, regarding to what is called the achievement of the people of Afghanistan over the past 20 years, including the press freedom, social society freedom, as well as women rights freedom and other issues related to human rights. But, however, inside Afghanistan, Meneha also urged the Taliban to pay respect to the demands of Afghan people, honor their basic rights, and allow especially girls and women to do their basic works and resume their normal life in order to have a right to go to schools, go to universities, be an artist, or similar issues. In the meantime, some top political leaders of Afghanistan are going to go to the Qatari capital, Doha, in order to meet the leadership of Taliban there. Hamid Karzai, the former Afghan president, Abdullah Abdullah, the former High National Reconciliation Council for Afghanistan, are two members of this delegation. Gulbuddin Hikmatyar, who is the leader of Hizbi Islami, is also another member of this delegation who are going to visit capital Doha. All these three members of this delegation have insisted on their strong will to find a solution for the Afghan conflict as a result of direct talks with the leadership of the Taliban in the Qatari capital Doha. For instance, Hamid Karzai optimistically said on a video message that was shared on social media that we are committed to bring peace in Afghanistan and we are in direct contact with the leaders of the Taliban either inside Afghanistan or abroad, mainly in the Qatari capital Doha. But let's not forget that the Taliban seems to behave something in different ways against what they had done 20 years ago in Afghanistan during their rule over Afghanistan. For instance, they are trying to be kind, to be friendly with locals inside the cities, and they have assured the people of Afghanistan, especially the residents of Kabul, to be inside their houses and get out for their works, and even they called on the employees of the Afghan government, the military employees and the non-military employees of the Afghan government to get back to their offices. However, there are also some unconfirmed reports that the Taliban have in some cases gone to the doors of some residents of Kabul, mainly the military employees of the Afghan government, especially the Afghan pilots who were working in the Afghan Air Force. But the Taliban sources has not commented regarding to this issue so far. In the meantime, the people of the residents of Kabul want an assurance, further guarantee, in order to resume their normal life in Afghanistan. However, they also blame the international community, mainly the United States of Afghanistan, for failing to achieve its stated goals and its promises to the people of Afghanistan, mainly bringing stability and peace to this country.
Thank you very much for that, Amin Ali. We appreciate it. Let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. We have writer, blogger, social activist, and director of the Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University, Sayed Muaz Shah, who joins us from Karachi. Also joining us, publisher and editor at Politics First, Marcus Papadopoulos, who joins us from London. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, Sayed Muaz Shah. We're very curious, along with the rest of the world, as to why we saw the downfall of Afghanistan, especially when it came to the lack of resistance from the Afghan army and how quickly the Taliban was able to take over the country. You know, that's a big question mark when put into the context that the U.S. was there for 20 years, and one of the core missions that they had was to train the Afghan army. Is it because of that failure, or is it something else?
I think it's a little bit deeper than that, and I think we have to look at, when we talk about the morale or vision behind why someone fights, and I think it's as basic as that. So when we talk about the Kabul regime that was there, one of the main key aspects, as you hinted, was a lot of U.S. money and funding, and some estimates put it at almost $450 million on an annual basis. So where you have that flow of money and sustainability through funds, you have to ask yourself, you have to go ask the soldier who's fighting, what is he fighting for? What is that vision? Whereas if you look at the case in Taliban, you know, their fighters are not getting paid. Essentially, they're volunteers of local. And they've sold the idea and the vision that they are fighting for their country to get it back from occupiers. And I think that's one of the most centralized themes that we have kind of glaze over, but it's the morale. And if you ask any military expert, they'll tell you that the morale of an army is very important. And so what's happened was, when the Americans had lifted their hand of support earlier this year, you quickly had seen a sort of helplessness in the ranks. There was some resistance, but there wasn't that vision there. There was that essence of the American essence disappearing. And there's a feeling that the money's going to disappear and the stability is going to disappear, and that's what the stability depended on. And we can criticize, you know, those people can criticize America shouldn't have left yet. They should have, you know, done more, waited till it was more stable. But the reality is that, what is that vision? I mean, if we look at the current, the Kabul regime structure, it was 18% reported voter turnout. Is that truly a representation of the people of Afghanistan? Were they all involved in that process? And the people who were in power understood that. And that's one of the things why they were kind of skeptical about involving the Taliban in the talks much earlier, because they were afraid of losing power because of where the Taliban strongholds were. They might get outvoted in a, you know, voting booth. So that was also a concern that eventually, you know, kind of fell out because of the Doha Accords. So they had to come to the table anyways, because the American support was evaporating. So I think the key thing I would say is morale and the vision that was sold. And that's something that the Taliban definitely fed on. They definitely fed on the historical experience of the Afghanistani people, from what the British had done earlier, then the Russians. And that was something similar that in this scenario, that they also sold that vision. And I think that was extremely important in how they convinced. And, of course, some of the miscalculations that the U.S. and Afghan forces did with the Bagram Air Base, and we know the horrors and torture issues that came out of there, and including the raids on people's houses. So I think that definitely fell more in their favor and only increased their momentum, and we've seen it unfold just a few days ago.
Well, Marcus Papadopoulos, if what our guest there is saying, if you agree with, it's just another way that this war was misrepresented, because we know that the U.S. misrepresented the war to the world, but in particular also to the American people. At this point, you know, this war has been called a colossal failure for the U.S., and basically you have the allies that have condemned the U.S. over this botched, as they call, end to the 20-year NATO campaign. You have, for example, a leading German politician that says it's the biggest debacle in the alliance's history. Do you see this as being that?
Can I first of all say that I cannot praise Press TV highly enough for its professional and insightful coverage of the situation in Afghanistan. And I would also like to take this opportunity to condemn the appallingly useless coverage of developments in Afghanistan by British mainstream media, whose reporters and columnists from outlets such as The Telegraph, The Guardian, and Sky News have clearly demonstrated that their knowledge of Afghanistan is largely drawn from Wikipedia, and that their only expertise is narcissism, attention seeking, and seeking Pulitzer Prizes. Now, in regard to the Taliban's conquest of Afghanistan, the ease in which the Taliban was able to conquer Afghanistan to easily defeat the Afghan army gives rise to serious suspicion, in my estimation. Serious suspicion that the Americans and the British have arrived at an informal agreement with the Taliban, because the Taliban's victory was so easy, too easy. It was truly startling. The Taliban was able to conquer parts of Afghanistan where it traditionally had never received considerable support. And history tells us that the Americans and the British only retreat from a country of geostrategic importance, if they are defeated on the battlefield. So, for example, the American military was defeated in Vietnam by the North Vietnamese military and by the Viet Cong, hence why the Americans withdrew. But the American military and the British military was not defeated by the Taliban. And at the same time, the American and the British military did not defeat the Taliban as well. So that is why I believe that the Americans and the British have not withdrawn from Afghanistan. Yes, their soldiers have withdrawn, but American and British influence and control in countries around the world is more than just a military one. I believe that the future is this, that the Taliban have evolved. The Taliban is no longer what it was during the 1990s and going into 2000 and 2001. I believe the Taliban understand that if they are to safeguard their dominance in Afghanistan, then they have to change. But at the same time, the Americans and the British look to the Taliban as an organization that they can do business with, so to speak, concerning the opium trade, but also threatening, for instance, Central Asia, which of course is Russia's backyard. And the Americans and the British can use the Taliban to cause problems in Central Asia, such as Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, and Kyrgyzstan, in the hope that terrorism will spread rapidly into Central Asia and will then enter Russia. So, in short, I do not believe the Americans and the British have truly left Afghanistan.
Okay, well, let's then break this angle open, because that's worthy of elaborating on it. And if you agree with that, Sayyid Muaz Shah, that puts a different viewpoint onto the way that our guest mentioned the U.S. and the U.K. militarily not to be in the country, however, possibly to put some weight in terms of, as our guest there said, do business with the Taliban to perhaps maneuver the group against Russia, maneuver the group inside the West Asia region, maybe against China, maybe against Iran. Do you think that those are possibilities?
Well, that's an interesting perspective, and I wouldn't rule that out, because as you can see, the Taliban has been very open about stating that we would like to have international relations, we would like to have international trade, and there's a lot of focus on that. They're basically trying to illustrate that we are not going to be isolationist as we were before. Not to mention that the Americans had dealings with the Taliban even before 2001, and we know that, you know, there was a lot of even business deals, and Taliban representatives even came over and visited the United States in the 90s. So we know that that space is there to potentially explore. But I think I would like to go back to the speech that Biden gave last month. And if you remember, on July 4th, he was getting a lot of questions on Afghanistan and finally held a press conference explaining the American position. And he said verbatim in his speech that, you know, this is the graveyard of empires. And he reiterated the reflection about what happened to the British and the Russians. And he said this is not going to be any different for us. So I'd kind of take Marcus's comment and kind of take it one step further, as he said that they haven't, you know, the place that they've retreated from is where they have been defeated. And here they had seen an inevitable defeat. So unless they would get something out of it, they would not. And I think I would give credit more to the British than the Americans, because they're very skilled at this, which is called they managed decline. And the British Empire has been able to kind of do that more successfully, whereas the Americans are more younger in this approach. So possibly, yes, there is space for that. But I see that whenever the backstep that is made, because the Americans were kind of really involved in Afghanistan, that's allowed the space to open up and allow other characters come at play. And we know another country that's taken a backstep in the Afghanistan situation is India, and that's because of certain dynamics on the ground. So now this vacuum, you see the Chinese and the Russians, they openly declared, hey, our embassies are going to be open. We're still going to be issuing visas, business as normal. The Pakistanis also themselves, they've said that, declared it today. So you have certain people where, you know, consulates and embassies are closing down for the United States and India and some other nations. And here, UN is also kind of securing its staff. So we're in a really kind of volatile situation. And as Marcus says, no one was honestly expecting it this rapid. I mean, I just like to take the timeline just a little bit back before Sunday. If you remember, on Friday in Doha, they were having a meeting between Pakistan, United States, the United Kingdom, Russia, China, and then the Afghan representative came in late into that meeting. They had some discussion on Saturday. If you remember, there was an open announcement that we're sending back 3,600 troops. For what? To secure the embassy and the retreat and the exit. Why would you take the soldiers out and then bring them back? And so clearly, I felt that that was the message that they were saying, that maybe they were going to kind of do this last-minute gasp effort. And I think that sped up the Taliban situation, frankly. And that night, Jalalabad and those surrounding areas of Kabul fell, and we woke up Sunday morning, and what do you know? Lo and behold, they surrounded Kabul. So I think that was, I think, unprecedented and unexpected on all levels, even with the Taliban. I don't think they were even expecting this rapid of a collapse.
Okay, since we're just fresh out of time, my last question goes to you, Marcus Papadopoulos. Many countries, including the U.S., very concerned about the fact that Afghanistan may turn out to be or become a hotbed for terrorists and a breeding ground for terrorists. And I'm going to forge that question into what the Taliban has said and what you referred to, I believe, and that is the fact that the Taliban is showing a different face than what it was back in the 90s in order to get that international recognition, which it has now with some countries like, I don't want to use the word recognition, but we know that Russia and, for example, China are open and receptive now towards the Taliban. Do you think that the Taliban will allow Afghanistan to be a terrorist hotspot, or will it go the route for the international recognition part in order to make sure that the country at least stays stable and secure?
Well, the Taliban has clearly learned from its mistakes of the past. The Taliban clearly understands in 2021 the importance of public relations. Nonetheless, the Taliban still adheres to an extremist ideology. And even though the Russians and the Chinese embassies remain open in Kabul, that is for the time being. The Taliban has not simply did not simply disappear following the American invasion of Afghanistan nearly 20 years ago. We know that the Americans and the British were, on the one hand, fighting against the Taliban, but on the other, they were talking with them. And the most important aspect of that is the latter. What were they talking with them about? And it is very clear to me that the speed and the ease in which the Taliban conquered Afghanistan is highly suspicious.
Very well. We're going to unfortunately leave it there. Thank you very much for that. Let me thank first the correspondent at the top of the spotlight, Alami, who spoke to us, writer, blogger, social activist, and director of the Center for Human Rights at Ziauddin University, Sayyid Muaz Shah, spoke to us from Karachi. Thank you. And publisher and editor at Politics First, Marcus Papadopoulos from London. And that is for this edition of The Spotlight. From me, Kavit Tahway, and the entire team is goodbye until next time. Thank you.
This is the Heart of Life pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Human rights defenders have recently accused the Biden administration of joining its predecessors in undercounting the number of civilians killed during U.S. wars. As the latest annual Pentagon report on non-combatants killed by American bombs and bullets was blasted as grossly inadequate by a leading ACLU official. Dear listeners, please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Brett Wilkins, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden joins long line of presidents to woefully undercount civilians killed in U.S. wars. Here's more. Human rights defenders have recently accused the Biden administration of joining its predecessors in undercounting the number of civilians killed during U.S. wars. As the latest annual Pentagon report on non-combatants killed by American bombs and bullets was blasted as grossly inadequate by a leading ACLU official. According to a Department of Defense report, U.S. forces killed 23 civilians last year during military operations in Afghanistan, Iraq, Somalia, Syria, and Yemen. However, the true number of civilians killed by U.S. attacks in 2020 was far higher, according to organizations that monitor such casualties. The UK-based journalistic monitoring group Air Wars, for example, reported between 34 and 36 civilian deaths caused by U.S.-led attacks on Daesh targets in Iraq and Syria last year. Air Wars also reported between 7 and 13 civilians killed by U.S. forces in Somalia last year. A December 2020 report by Nita C. Crawford of the Cost of War Project, a team of 50 scholars, legal experts, human rights practitioners, and physicians at Brown University's Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs in Rhode Island, found that at least 83 civilians were killed in 24 separate U.S. attacks in the first 9 months of last year. While the discrepancy between the number of civilian casualties in 2020 acknowledged by the U.S. and figures reported by independent monitors and media is stark, it was even greater in 2019. That year, the Pentagon claimed responsibility for 132 civilian deaths, while Air Wars and the Cost of War Project reported more than 1,100 civilians killed by U.S.-led attacks in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria alone. The dramatic decline in civilians killed and injured by U.S. forces is a result of a major decrease in overall American bombing attacks in at least six nations targeted in the so-called War on Terror. Air Wars estimates U.S. warplanes and drones carried out approximately 1,000 strikes last year, down from around 3,500 bombings in 2019 and 13,000 airstrikes in 2016, the last full year of the Obama administration. Hena Shamsi, director of the ACLU's National Security Project, blasted the latest administration to undercount the number of civilians killed in U.S. wars. Almost 20 years into our country's unending conflicts, the Biden administration joins its predecessors in undercounting the number of civilians, likely all black or brown people, killed or injured in U.S. military operations overseas, Shamsi said in a statement, adding, compared to credible independent media accounts, United Nations reporting and rights groups investigations, it is clear that the Defense Department's investigations and acknowledgement of civilian harm remain woefully inadequate. The grossly inadequate official accounting for the cost and consequences of the United States' lethal actions abroad prevents meaningful public oversight and accountability for wrongful deaths and perpetual war policies, Shamsi added. Civilian victims, their families, and the American public deserve far better than this. Successive U.S. administrations have attempted to undercount or conceal the true number of civilians killed during the so-called War on Terror. Former President Donald Trump, who infamously vowed to bomb the Daesh and their families while subsequently loosening rules of engagement meant to protect civilians, signed a 2019 executive order revoking an Obama-era requirement that the Director of National Intelligence publish an annual report on civilian deaths caused by drone strikes in areas outside of war zones, but under U.S. attack, including Somalia, Yemen, Pakistan, and Libya. During the tenure of the former President Barack Obama, who dramatically escalated unmanned aerial drone strikes, CIA Director John Brennan claimed that not a single civilian was killed by airstrikes in Pakistan in nearly 1 year period in 2010 to 2011, during which the Bureau of Investigative Journalism counted dozens of casualties. Obama, under whom U.S. forces bombed medical facilities, homes, weddings, funerals, first responders, U.S. citizens, and allied forces, also redefined the term militant to include all military-age males in a designated strike zone in an attempt to artificially lure civilian casualty counts. And the administration of former President George W. Bush, who invaded Iraq under false pretenses and under whom the majority of civilian deaths in the war on terror he started occurred, also repeatedly came under fire for undercounting civilian casualties. As General Tommy Franks infamously declared on the eve of the Iraq invasion, we don't do body counts. While such an attitude makes it virtually impossible to tell exactly how many men, women, and children have been killed by U.S. forces over the past 2 decades of unending war, estimates range from around 500,000 to well over 1 million.
With you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.